studio on March 2nd, 2006 to interview Garth Reeves about his personal history. Describe when and where were you born and a bit about your parents and grandparents.
Well, I was born in Nassau, Bahamas. And 4 months after my birth, my parents decided to move to Miami. So I've been around since 1919, which is, I celebrated my 87th birthday last month. And I've been, I grew up here. I went to Booker T. Washington High School. I had 4 sisters who also went there and grew up here. And we all went to college and got degrees. My sisters got advanced degrees. I didn't get any further than the BS. But the rest is history. I've been around here all my life except the 4 years I spent in the United States Army from 1942 to 46.
What was it like growing up where you did? Describe what your community was like when you were a child. What neighborhood did you live in and what was around? What place did you go as a child and was it segregated?
Well, believe it or not, that's a long question, but that's all right. Growing up here in Miami, things were pretty tough, but we didn't have television. And so we didn't know really about all the things that happened in the outside world. And I guess that was the secret of our parents, because most of our parents were dirt poor. But they acted like they were rich or like we were not missing anything. And they thought that they made us feel that we were blessed to be here and to have an opportunity, as limited as it was. And so not knowing all these other things existed during the time, we felt pretty good about ourselves. We had our own neighborhood, which was Overtown, and we all lived among ourselves. All our schools were segregated, and all the entertainment places. And we sort of got along and didn't worry about a lot of things. We had unpleasantries, but we kind of grew used to the segregated pattern of life because to resist it, you always lost. You were always outnumbered. And you did not understand a lot of the things that happened, nor did you go along with the things that were denied you. But your parents were always there to remind you that don't rock the boat, don't get into trouble. And we grew up sort of, I remember when I went into the Army, my mother told me, learn to stay alive. Learn to come back home, and then you can do something about these things that you complain about now. And I guess we learned to be people who could exist, who could manage to stay alive despite the disparities of the day. The Army?
Yeah, if you knew it was segregated,
Well, I really didn't decide to join. They, we had the draft during that time. And I had just come out of college, and I was working with my father in the newspaper business and printing. And we were doing pretty good. And then I remember I was coming back from Orlando where we had attended the Orange Blossom Classic in December 1941. And when I got home, my dad rushed out to the car and said, the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. And I said, who the hell is Pearl Harbor? And I really knew, I never knew the place existed before. And we found out we were at war. And that was in December 1941. 2 months later, in February 1942, I was in the Army. And they did it by a draft. They pulled your numbers out of a lottery in those days to see who would go to the Army first, or not the Army, the Armed Forces. And my name must have been number one because they got me as soon as they started the lottery. My name popped out of there, and I had to go down and to the draft board. And I really didn't want to go to service because I really tried to get in the Air Force earlier in 1941, before the war started. And everything was segregated during that time, but I had read about the Tuskegee Airmen, and they had started this program, and I said, well, maybe I could get into that and wouldn't have to have all the indignities that I met with after I got into the Army. But it didn't work out. And I got all my letters in, my letters of recommendation. I had people in the community to write good reports on me. But before I could get accepted into the Air Force, I was drafted into the United States Army. I went into the Army in February 1942, and by April 1942, I was on the Queen Elizabeth headed for England, overseas. It happened so fast, but the war was heating up then, and the German submarines were playing games with us right off the coast of the Atlantic coast. Many of you might remember the history that they sank ships not very far from Miami and Palm Beach in those areas. And I think that's the reason we went overseas so fast. They needed men. They needed men fast. They needed troops. And as soon as we were trained, and I went to Mississippi for training, and as soon as we were trained, they put us on a boat and shipped us overseas. And I remember I was very uncomfortable in going overseas because I knew the U-boats, the German U-boats, were sinking a lot of ships. And we went on the Queen Elizabeth with no convoy. You know what a convoy is? They take all the ships together and put the battleships and the destroyers around it to protect it. Well, we were out there in the Atlantic alone, nobody but Queen Elizabeth. And I was quite concerned, but they told me that we were traveling so fast, the U-boats could not keep up with us. I said, well, I hope that's true. Anyhow, we got to England in 7 days. Scotland. That's where we landed, at Greenock, Scotland. And that's where we went on down into England, and I started my overseas career there. I stayed overseas maybe 8 months, and I was shipped back to the States to study, to go to Officers' Candidate School. I was a technical sergeant at the time, and I wanted to go back to anti-aircraft school in the States. So I put in my application for officer school, and I was accepted. And I was shipped back to a camp, Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And when I got off the plane that night, a black sergeant met me and looked at my papers. He said, are you sure you're in the right place? I said, well, this is where they sent me. Here are the papers. And he told me, he said, that's funny. We've never had a black in this school as long as I've been here. And I've been here 22 years. We never had a black to be an officer in this school. I said, look, you're looking at my papers, so let's go. So he took me to the camp. It was at night. And they gave me a room. And the next morning, they had cut my papers to move me out of there. The charge knew what he was talking about. Because they said it was a big mistake and I was not supposed to be there. Well, that was the first discrimination I came up with. And so they sent me to a camp down in Camp Davis, North Carolina, where an anti-aircraft artillery school for the officers' training. Well, I was pretty disturbed about that, but what can you do? We went along. Anyhow, I finished the course, but I didn't graduate. I got my uniform and everything, this number and all, but at the last minute, I was yanked out of the class. I never found out about it, but it wasn't too bad because I found out later a lot of the guys who finished in my class had gone overseas, and a lot of them didn't come back. So sometimes things happen for the best. Sometimes discrimination works in your favor. Well, not very good. They never let you forget you were black. They always let you know, because I was in the 383rd Engineer Battalion. We could build bridges and a lot of things. We did build roads. We were a pretty good outfit, but actually, when we got overseas, we were doing more work details. We didn't really, they hadn't invaded France at the time, and we were sort of biding our time. And they didn't ask us really to do a lot of things. They didn't, I could see that they were not going to put us into combat. They didn't want us to fight. They didn't think we were smart enough, really, to fight. And I didn't worry about it. I was having a good time in England. I remember my mother going over. My mother told me, we had a lot of problems when I was young, of black men getting lynched. And normally it was for a black man was supposed to have insulted a white man or assaulted a white woman, or it was something, but anything that came up, there were all sorts of reasons to be lynched. And my mother was afraid of that. She was saying, don't, for God's sake, leave those white women alone. I said, well, Mom, you don't see, I've never seen me follow white women. Why do you think I'm in? She said, no, but I'm just warning you, because that's the only way you seem to get in trouble here. The people seem to. And then when I got to England, there were no black women. And the white women were, they didn't bother about my color at all. And I had a good time. We had. But I didn't let that. When I got back home, I remembered what my mother told me, you're still black. And I never, well, I always thought that you, as an aside, I was never enthused about white women, because among the black race, you have all women, all colors, from white to black, to any color you want. And I never saw the reason that I had to chase behind a white woman. There was nothing against him and all that, but that's the way I felt. But that was another thing back in Miami. You just remembered that discrimination still existed. And although you had gone overseas and you had gone and fought in the war for a total of, I was in the Army for 46 months. But when I came back home, nothing had changed. Everything was just the same. I still had to go to the, we still went to the to the black theater. We still went to the black clubs. All our kids still went to the black schools. And it was just, we've been along with the program. Things are a lot different today. And I applaud you kids for taking advantage of all the things, all the opportunities we missed during that time.
Mr. Reeves, did you have transportation to and from your training camp?
Did I have what?
Transportation to and from your training camp.
Confrontations?
Transportation.
Transportation. Transportation. To and from?
Your training army camps.
I don't quite understand your question.
How did you get to your training army camp?
In the camp? Oh, we had white officers. All my officers were white in training. Yeah, but no black officers except one who was the chaplain. And they did all the training. We had the 383rd Engineer Battalion was about 1,100 men. But all the men were black and all the officers were white. Patriotic, as well as I could be. I still have something today against flying the American flag on a flagpole. I always saluted it and I respected it. And I stood up at the Star-Spangled Banner. But in my home, I have a 25-foot flagpole on my pool deck where the boat is. And I never ran up the American flag on my pole. I always ran up that. One time I had Mandela's flag, and one time I had the flag of the Bahamas where I was born. But there's something that always kept me from running that American flag up the pole, because although I resented the way I was treated, I respected it, but not to the point where I would be a rah-rah guy for the American flag. I didn't wave the flag. I respected it, but I didn't wave it. I think the worst part was I was in a camp where after they had captured a lot of soldiers, Italian soldiers, German soldiers overseas, and a lot of them were shipped back to the United States. And many of them were incarcerated at the camps where the American soldiers were. The American soldiers were the guards, and they kept them in check and all that. But at one camp, I saw we couldn't go into the PX. The PX was the post exchange where you bought beer and things like that. We had our own post exchange, and it was for the blacks. But believe it or not, the prisoners of war from Italy were using the white post exchange. Now, I could not understand that, but here the prisoners, the ones we were fighting against, the enemy was getting more rights to be white. I thought that was very, very strange, and that was something I couldn't live with, but what could you do about it? Nothing. Well, I was a personnel sergeant major of my battalion, where I was in the headquarters company. And that was a pretty good job because I kept all the records. And the way I got there, because when I first went in the Army, everybody was new and they didn't know what to do. And the captain came out one day and said, "Anybody in here can type?" And my hand went up. And he wanted, he got me in, he said, look, we got a lot of things to do. We're getting ready to go overseas. And we got a lot of records that needed to be filled out. And I need somebody to keep the records and the type and all that. He said, if you work with me, I'll take care of you. So I spent a lot of time with him and helped him get his records right and all that. And sure enough, he made me a corporal. And at the end, before, and 3 months later, I was a technical sergeant because I had mastered all of his training manuals and I knew what to do and I was getting it done. And so I became a five-star soldier, a five-stripe soldier. A technical sergeant was a pretty good rank. That was just one stripe below the master sergeant and the first sergeant. So I had a pretty good deal, and I think I got a lot of privileges because I had gone to college, and a lot of guys I had gone into the service with were not as educated. And I thought the more education you had, I think the higher you got. Well, all of us were there together. Although I trained with a bunch of men from New York, Philadelphia, and Boston. And they were much more outspoken than I was, because I was from the Deep South and I knew my place down in the Deep South. But these guys talked a bit, but they had to do the same thing. They had to swallow their pride and accept all these discriminatory tactics that were placed in their way, the same as I did. Nobody liked it, but nobody could do anything about it. So I had a pretty good deal when I was always out. I like being inside, especially when the weather's bad and you have to go out in the snow to soldier. So I always had a pretty good deal. Well, my mother, she knew I didn't want to go into the service because I didn't have my heart into it, and she just said, be a survivor. Learn to be a survivor. Don't try to win the war by yourself. Try to come back home safely. And with that attitude, I think she helped me through a lot of trying times. A lot of trying times. Yes.
How were you treated in South Florida?
Yeah, everything was the same, but Miami had been a little different then. We were still locked down in Overtown, but I don't know. Miami was, I thought about all the good times I had down on Second Avenue, the clubs we went to. We had the big bands to come to town. And I thought, I was not worried about, people were worried so much about the integration. As long as I had a fair shot at being able to enjoy myself, I don't have to be with the white person company. It was a strange thing. You didn't want to accept segregation, but you wondered, Now when I was in the Army, I went to a lot of places. And I came back home and I talked to my mother. I said, I think I'm leaving town. And she said, why? I said, I've been in a lot of big places, a lot of places I like a lot better than Miami. She said, name a few. So I said, Chicago, I like New York, I like Seattle, Washington, I like New Orleans, I said, pretty women in New Orleans, and Washington, D.C., and New York, and I named all these places. And she said, well, I'll tell you what. I want you to stay home because your father has a business there, and I think he wants you. He would be disappointed if you left home. And she said, but let me tell you, anywhere you go today in this country, you're going to find prejudice and discrimination. And so she said, you might go places like New York and Boston where you can ride in the front of the bus and go to any theater or any restaurant you want, but you will find that you will be segregated the same way once they see the color of your skin. And I thought about that a long time. But I had run upon it. I had seen segregation in places I didn't think it would be. Like Washington, D.C. was very segregated. That was not one of the places I would have gone. But my wife was there. My first wife was living in Washington, and I thought she wanted me to come there, and she thought it would be much better. But anyhow, I stayed home, and I'm glad I did, because it changed my mindset. My mother said, why run away from what you don't like? Why don't you stay here and do something about it? So I said, what can I do? She said, you can make changes. Make changes. You don't like it? Say so. Your daddy's got a newspaper. Use that. And she kind of kindled something in my mind about using the press in order to fight your battles instead of with guns and sticks. And at that time, I got interested in the newspaper business. Before that, my father had a printing place in two parts. He had a newspaper in one part, and then he had commercial job printing in the other part. And I always worked in the commercial job printing because that's where the money was. There's plenty of money there. But in the newspaper, it was very difficult because advertising, white people did not advertise with us. We got a few advertisements and from the black community. But that's why I stayed over in the job department. And then when my mother told me to use the newspaper, I moved over and started writing articles about discrimination and prejudice. And at that time, the main thing was really, it was still lynching. And discrimination and segregation. And that's what we talked about. We pointed it out to the people. You might not be able to do anything about it, but at least we want you to know about it, that what you are doing is wrong and it should be corrected. And I think that our newspaper did a good job because the Miami Herald and the Miami Daily News, which was published at that time, was not gung-ho about the civil rights of black people. They didn't publish anything much about protests. They published the news, and it kind of went along with everybody else. It's the status quo. But the Miami Times was always there talking about the segregated patterns and why are the black schools so different from the white schools? Why have the white schools got more facilities than the black schools? And we thought it was very important to keep hammering those things home. And we stayed on it. We stayed on that all the time. We kept pointing out the inequities of the system, which were many. And I think today, a lot of people have benefited by our protests. And we were strong in that. We took part in all the protest movements, all the civil rights movements. We were represented all the time. We brought the news as it was. We didn't print just what any person other than us wanted to say, but we tried to bring the news as it happened and tell the truth, tell it as it was. And I think that's one of our legacies today, that we hung in there.
Did you print anything on the war?
On the war, yes. Well, the war still went on after, of course, it ended. When I got out, the war had ended, because I remember I was on a ship going to Pearl Harbor, believe it or not. The second, when the war in Europe ended, and we were going over there to train for the invasion of Japan, because we had won the war in Germany at that time. So our lights, our focus was on Japan. And I was in a regiment then, and we went to Japan and started training for the invasion. I did not like that idea of invading Japan, because I had read the intelligence reports that we were getting, that we were looking to lose 2 million casualties. That was it. That was what the intelligence told us, that we got to look to lose 2 million. I said, 2 million casualties? That's a lot of people. And they said the Japanese were stubborn people. They would fight to the end, and it would not be an easy task, but the only way we would completely win the war was to defeat the Japanese. Now, while we were training, you know what happened? They decided to drop the bomb. And that turned the war around. Good or bad, the atomic bomb is what ended the war, because it rained so much destruction down on Japan that they gave up, I think, in a week or two. And then that's how we ended the war. I don't know if introducing the atomic bomb to the world was good or bad. We have yet to find out about it.
How do you feel about the atomic bomb?
Could you pause it for a second, Odie? What were some of the countries you visited while in the war? QE2.
Well, we sailed on the QE2 in August of 42. 7 days later, we landed in Greenock, Scotland. We came down, and we were based in England, at Derbyshire, Derby, England. And we stayed there, I imagine, most of the time. We were training, supposedly training, and I imagine, for the war, but we were doing mainly maintenance work and quartermaster work and things like that. Not a lot of combat training and things like that. So I think we were being used basically more like a quartermaster corps, a service group, because they still did not have black fighting men then. Now, something happened while I was in England. A lot of people were getting killed, and they were all white, seemingly, because blacks were not fighting. Well, if you were not in the ranks up front, you were pretty safe. So they got the bright idea, well, why don't we get some blacks killed too? So let them fight. So they actually passed the law. They said if anybody wanted to fight, they could volunteer and they could get in a combat unit. But they had a couple of tricks to it. If you wanted to fight, if you wanted to go in a combat unit, you had to give up all your rank. That means you were back to a private again. Well, I was a technical sergeant. So I said, well, gee, I wonder why they would have it so stringent. If they really wanted you in a combat unit, they would absorb your rank with it. But they did not. They said, no, if you want to be in a combat unit, you whatever. But most of the people said, listen, I wasn't good enough to fight when you brought me here. I'll stay right here and do what I'm doing now. And thanks with no thanks. And I felt the same way. I felt the same way. I said, well, why now that the white boys are getting killed, you wanna get us over there now, so you know. But then why make it so tough by taking our rank? That wasn't very, very smart, but that's the way they did it. Now, when I left England, I came back to the United States, where I found out that at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, that we talked about, and ended up washing out of school at the Coast Artillery. After that, I went to Fort Huachuca, Arizona. From there, we shipped to, that's when I was on the QE, not the QE2, going to, when the war ended in Germany, we were on the way to Pearl Harbor. And we landed in Pearl Harbor and began training for the invasion of Japan. And before we ended our training there, the war in Japan ended. Now, that's the chronological up there. I never went into combat anywhere. I stayed in the Army 46 months, but was never in a combat area. No, it was a great experience. I think that I hadn't done a lot of traveling before I went into the service. And the Army did me a great service. It took me to many places. I traveled all over. And it gave me a chance to see places that I've never seen before and have experiences I'd never had before. But The sting of the segregation pattern never did quite rub off on me, never did quite leave me, and I still have some bad thoughts about how I was treated, because yeah, I don't think it was fair to wave the flag at me and tell me that I'm bringing you into the Army to go out and make the world safe for democracy and get me into the Army and then treat me like I'm a second-class citizen and not do what you promised to do, to treat me fair. So that was it. It's good and the bad about the Army. I have mixed emotions about it. Yes, I went to Jewish concentration camp. I visited them after the war, not during the war. I was in Germany, and I wanted to see a concentration camp. I'd heard so much about it. Now I did visit it there. No, really, I had no idea it was that serious. We heard some terrible things, but I had no idea they were exterminating people that way, burning people in incinerators like that. I thought they must be wrong about that, but it turned out they were not.
reaction when you found out Mr. Reeves?
When I found out what?
About the concentration camps. And oh, where
are
you?
I was horrified to see what really happened. When you saw the result, like the ashes and the bones that were left, and it was very difficult to comprehend people treating people like that, other people like that. It was a horrible experience, and I guess you really had to go and see those things in order to believe them, because today a lot of people don't believe those things happened. And they did. The evidence is there. But that's history, and you can't change that.
Do you hold a grudge on anything on discrimination that was said to you?
Hold a grudge?
Yeah, to those people who put you down while you were in the war.
No. I remember a lieutenant from Texas talking to me about it. He was a graduate of Texas A&M University, and I was Florida A&M University. We used to talk, and he thought it was right to separate the races. He felt that way. He said, "Yeah, I think so," but. I said, "Well, what do you prove by that?" And he said, "Well, he just felt that white people were more prepared to deal with situations than blacks." He was trying to explain to me why no black officers were in our regiment. And I said, "Well, how can you tell? You don't have any hair." And but he was a true segregationist. But it was nothing. Seemed with him, it was like it was nothing personal. He just believed that he was right. He said he thought it was right that we were treated that way. Take advantage of all opportunities that are presented to you. And when you get knocked down, get up again, because nobody's going to have an easy shot. Nobody gets, it's no free lunch today. I think a lot of people are looking for a free lunch. And there's no free lunch. You got to pay for everything you get. You will not get everything it's due you. How did that expression go? But you will say you said get everything that you have to work for. And if
nothing is free, something like that. Nothing is free in this world, something like that. I think Zaya said something that nothing is free in this world. Everything has to be free. I don't remember right now, but I know.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Reeves.
Asked to move to the back of the train. Can you give us some of that details of what happened on the train?
When you were coming back to Miami.
Oh, yes.
When you were dressed in uniform.
Oh, yes. Well, I was shipping I was shipping ones from Texas, I think, to Seattle, Washington, in order to go to the Pacific when we were heading to Hawaii. And I had this ticket and called for a Pullman and a dinner car and all that, which all the soldiers got. And I got on the plane in, I think it was Louisiana somewhere. And I got I asked the porter to show me to my seat, my Pullman. I said, I'm ready to go to bed this night. And so he said, you just have a seat over there. I'll take care of you later. And I waited. An hour later, he came back through, and I said, well, I'm ready to go to bed. I'm waiting on my seat. And he said, just sit down there. He kept putting me off, and I demanded. I said, well, look, now, I'm tired, and I'm on my way overseas. I said, I need to get my Pullman, sir. And he told me in no uncertain terms, if you don't sit down here, I got the MPs on this train. We're going to lock you up. I said, no, you got to be kidding. And no, he said, no, he wasn't kidding. And I rode coach all the way from Louisiana across the country to the West Coast in coach. I never did get my seat. Never did get my Pullman. Yeah, and so I asked him for my ticket back. I said, well, can I have my ticket back at least so I can turn it in? He said, no, he didn't give me my ticket back. You know, just these things, people treating you like that. You can't forget things like that. And they were happening to us all the time. Everybody did that. The government will sell you a ticket and charge you Pullman prices and everything to go across the country and then make you sit up in a coach. And then, but they don't refund the money or anything. It's just like that scam down in New Orleans after Katrina. God, they're treating the people down there. Look at our local company here, Carnival Cruise Lines. Look at the ripoff, $236 million ripoff that they did on the government. It's in the papers. Read about it. They're charging all this money, and they charged us like they were getting first-class treatment for everybody, and a lot of the ships were empty. Everybody seemingly wants to rip off the government for some reason.
Thank you.